So are ease and convenience. Think of decisions that require willpower, and then take willpower totally out of the equation. Step 2. Make decisions tonight so you won't need to make them tomorrow. It's also easier to make a smart choice when the decision isn't right in front of you. Pick easy decisions that will drain your store of willpower tomorrow and make them tonight. For example, choose what you'll wear. Leo Widrick, the co-founder of Buffer, found a way to make this decision incredibly easy. He wears jeans and a white t-shirt every day. Or decide what you'll have for breakfast. Scott Dorsey, the aforementioned co-founder of Exact Target, eats oatmeal with blueberries for breakfast every day. Maybe you'll choose to decide what you'll have for lunch. Just make sure to prepare it the night before. Or maybe you'll decide what time you'll work out. Just make sure to pack your workout gear the night before. The key is to take as many decisions off the board as you can the night before, because that will allow you to conserve tomorrow's mental energy for making the decisions that really matter. The goal is to make certain actions automatic rather than decisions, because decisions require willpower. The power of routine not only will make you more efficient, but will also make it a lot easier for you to make important decisions. When you don't have to make decisions, decision fatigue is very easy to avoid. Regardless of what decisions you decide to make, here's one thing you definitely should decide: what you'll do first when you get to work. That way you can... Step 3. Do the hardest things you need to do first. You have the greatest amount of mental energy early in the morning. Science says so. In a landmark study performed by the National Academy of Sciences, parole board judges were most likely to give a favorable ruling early in the morning. Just before lunch, the odds of a favorable ruling dropped to almost zero. Should the judges' decisions have been affected by factors other than legal ones? Of course not. But they were. Why? They got mentally tired. They experienced decision fatigue. That's why the best time to make tough decisions is early in the day. That's why the best time to do the most important things you need to do is early in the day. Decide what those things are and plan to tackle them first thing. I know what you're thinking. What about the rest of the day? Step 4. Refuel often. Although the judges in the study started the day strong, a graph of their decision-making looks like a roller coaster, up and down, up and down. Why? They took periodic breaks to eat or snack. Just after lunch, their likelihood of making favorable rulings spiked. The same held true after mid-morning and mid-afternoon breaks. It turns out glucose is one of the foundations of willpower. Although your brain does not stop working when glucose is low, it does start doing some things and stop doing others. It responds more strongly to immediate rewards and pays less attention to long-term outcomes. How can you avoid that? Eat healthy meals. Eat healthy snacks. Not only will you feel better, but you'll also make better decisions. And you'll be able to exercise more willpower in making those decisions. And while we're talking about long-term outcomes, step 5, create reminders of your long-term goals. You want to build a bigger company, but when you're mentally tired, it's easy to rationalize doing less than your best. Or you want to lose weight, but when you're mentally tired, it's easy to rationalize that it makes better sense to start your workout program tomorrow. Or you want to better engage with your employees. But when you're mentally tired, it's easy to rationalize that you really need to work on that proposal instead. Mental fatigue makes you take the easy way out, even though the easy way almost always takes you the wrong way. The solution is easy. Create tangible reminders designed to pull you back from the impulse brink. For example, a friend keeps a copy of his bank loan taped to his computer monitor as a constant reminder of an obligation he must meet. Another keeps a photo of himself when he weighed 50 pounds more on his refrigerator as a constant reminder of the person he never wants to be again. Another fills his desk with family photos, both because he loves looking at them and to remind himself of the people he hopes to provide for. Think of moments when you are most likely to give in to impulses that take you further away from your long-term goals. Then use tangible reminders of those long-term goals to interrupt the impulse and keep you on track. Step 6. Remove temptation altogether. Every time you have to decide not to do something you would like to do, even though what you would like to do runs counter to your goals, simply rework your environment so you eliminate your ability to be impulsive. Then you don't have to exercise any willpower at all. Take the candy jar off the counter and stash it in a cabinet. Turn off all your social media notifications and check your accounts only every couple of hours. Take a different route to work so you won't be tempted to pop into Starbucks. Or take the opposite approach. Put your running clothes on the floor by your bed so you'll have to put them away if you decide to skip your morning run. Keep your to-do list on top of your work pile so you'll have to move it and ignore it if you are tempted to work on something urgent but not important. Finding ways to avoid temptation is a great way to avoid needing to exercise willpower. So is the guilt you'll feel when you are required to take a physical action to avoid making the right choice. If your child is watching TV, it's easy to avoid reading her a story. But if she's standing in front of you holding a book, ouch. As you know by now, the key to accomplishing your goals is to build the right habits and follow the right routines. When you control your environment, you make building those habits easy, and you make following the right routines as close to automatic as possible. Want to go beyond practical tricks? Learn the philosophy of willpower. By now you know I'm big on processes, but I'm also big on mindset. The thought really is the parent of the deed. So what can you do when you need greater willpower and perseverance, and one of the practical tips just described won't get you over the determination hump? Take a step back and rely on the power of perspective. Consistently doing what you need to do to succeed with total focus and resolve is incredibly difficult. That's why the ability to work hard and respond positively to failure and adversity is so crucial. Resolve, willpower, and determination help successful people work hard and stick to their long-term goals. Want to develop those qualities? Embrace the following mindset. Let your past inform your future, but don't let it define your future. The past is valuable. Learn from your mistakes. Learn from the mistakes of others. Then let it go. Easier said than done? As I said before, everything depends on your perspective. When something bad happens to you, it's an opportunity to learn. When another person makes a mistake, it's an opportunity to be kind, forgiving, and understanding. The past doesn't define you. Just make sure that next time you know what to do differently. See your life and future as within your control. There's a quote often credited to Saint Ignatius of Loyola, and you have to love a fighting saint. Pray as if God will take care of all, act as if all is up to you. The same premise applies to luck. Many people feel luck has a lot to do with success or failure. If they succeed, luck favored them, and if they fail, luck was against them. Most successful people do feel that good luck played some role in the success they enjoy, but they don't wait for good luck or worry about bad luck. They act as if success or failure is totally within their control. If they succeed, they caused it. If they fail, they caused it. By not wasting mental energy worrying about what might happen to you, you can put all your effort into making things happen. And if you do get lucky, hey, even better. Learn to ignore the things you have no control over. Mental strength is like muscle strength. No one has an unlimited supply of focus, so why waste your power on things you can't control? For some people, it's politics. For others, it's family. For others, it's global warming. Whatever it is, you care, and you want others to care. Fine. Do what you can do. Vote. Lend a listening ear. Recycle and reduce your carbon footprint. Do what you can do. Be your own change. But don't try to make everyone else change. They won't. Don't just aim for tenacity. Aim for adaptability. When you think about special operations personnel, the first word that comes to mind is service, as in, thank you for your service, because we all owe military personnel our thanks. The next word that comes to mind is likely tenacity. SEALs, Army Rangers, Green Berets, their training is designed to identify people who can stay the course, no matter what. Yet, tenacity is not their most important quality. Take it from Tyler Gray, an Army Ranger who was deployed twice to Afghanistan and twice to Iraq before being badly injured by an explosion in 2005 in Baghdad. With special ops, Tyler told me, it's not people who are the absolute best at any one thing, but people who are really good at a number of things. That means you have to be adaptable because no one is good at everything. People tend to think Darwin said only the strong survive. That's not what he said. Darwin said the number one survivability trait is adaptability. Adaptability is what will get you through these selection processes. Adaptability is the ability to recognize the construct and working mechanisms of a system, figure out how it works, adapt to it, and then adapt it to your needs and goals. The thing is, you won't always succeed, at least not at first. Not if you're trying to do something difficult, something challenging, something worthwhile. So, how do you get past the pain, the struggle, and the occasional failure? Discomfort is growth, Tyler says. To constantly improve and to be more resilient and adaptable, whenever there is a fork in the road, choose discomfort over comfort, and you will grow. We're used to choosing comfort. We're used to choosing the easy way. Yet all our success and growth comes from choosing the hardest and least comfortable way. Say you're an entrepreneur. You chose the discomfort of giving up a paycheck and starting a company. Every success comes from taking the harder path. One of the best quotes I've ever heard says that if you want to increase the level of success, you need to increase the level of failure. There's a difference between quitting and failing. I'm okay with failing 1,000 times. As long as you just keep going and don't quit, you haven't really failed. Embrace that mindset, and you will never fail. You just won't have succeeded. Yet. Don't resent. Celebrate the success of others. Many people, I guarantee you know at least a few, see success as a zero-sum game. There's only so much to go around. When someone else shines, they think that diminishes the light from their stars. Resentment sucks up a massive amount of mental energy, energy better applied elsewhere. When a friend does something awesome, that doesn't prevent you from doing something awesome. In fact, where success is concerned, birds of a feather tend to flock together. So draw your successful friends even closer. Don't resent awesomeness. Create and celebrate awesomeness wherever you find it. And in time, you'll find even more of it in yourself. Resist the temptation to complain, criticize, or whine. Your words have power, especially over you. Harping about your problems always makes you feel worse, not better. If something goes wrong, don't waste time complaining. Put that mental energy into making the situation better. Unless you want to whine about it forever, eventually you'll have to make it better. And do the same with your friends or colleagues. Don't just serve as a shoulder they can cry on. Friends don't let friends whine. Friends help friends make their lives better too. Count your blessings. Before you turn out the light every night, take a moment to quit worrying about what you don't have. Quit worrying about what others have that you don't. Think about what you do have. You have plenty to be thankful for. Doesn't reminding yourself of all the things you have in your life, all the things you would miss desperately if they were taken away, feel amazing? Feeling better about yourself is the best way of all to recharge your mental batteries. And it's the best way to be happy. Because happiness is easily found when you appreciate what you already have. Of course, happiness is also found in achieving your goals. So, let's look at another simple strategy you can use to achieve a goal that takes more than a day or a week to accomplish. Chapter 5.5. One question provides nearly every answer. Before we do that, start asking yourself one question over and over and over again. Think about what you want to become. Maybe you want to become fit, trim, and healthy. Maybe you want to become a CEO. Maybe you want to become a business owner or a millionaire. Only you can decide what you want to become. But once you do, you can't blindly choose how you want to proceed. Not if you want to succeed. To be a certain thing, to become a certain thing, you must make the decisions that will get you there. Fortunately, making the right decisions is easy. Just ask yourself one question. That's how Herb Kelleher, the CEO of Southwest Airlines, makes so many decisions every day. Kelleher applies a simple framework to every issue. Will this help Southwest be the lowest cost provider? If so, the answer is yes. If not, the answer is no. The most effective people apply the same framework to the decisions they make. Will this help me reach my goal? If not, I won't do it. If you feel like you're constantly struggling to make decisions, take a step back. Think about your goals. Your goals will help you make decisions. That's why the most successful people seem so decisive. Indecision is born of a lack of purpose. When you know what you truly want, most of your decisions can and should be almost automatic. Say you don't just want to exercise. Say you want to be fit. Then imagine you're out to dinner and the waiter asks about dessert. Would a fit person have dessert? Probably not. On the other hand, if you're a fit person who has run 14 miles that day and burned a ton of calories, and dessert tonight fits within your routine and your process, then the answer is yes. Either way, you know the answer without thinking. And that means you don't need to rely on willpower or motivation because you made the choice before the choice was ever presented to you. Pretty cool, right? Here's another example. Say you're saving money to buy an investment property. That's your goal. But you drive a 2009 Nissan Titan, that's me, showing some signs of age, and you see this incredibly sleek Jaguar F-Type, a car you've always wanted. That's me again. Technically, you can afford it. Should you buy it? Would a person saving money to buy an investment property buy a new Jaguar? Nope. Easy. The list of examples goes on. Would a person who wants to become a supervisor, a manager, or a CEO treat other people with anything less than dignity and respect? No, because that's not the way good leaders act. Would a person who wants to be a good parent ignore a child who is struggling in school because spending time on social media is more, however oddly, gratifying? No, because that's not the way good parents act. What do you want to achieve? Whom do you want to become? Place yourself there. Say, I am fit. Say, I am a CEO. Say, I am a millionaire. Say, I am a great parent. You'll get the answer you need, and you'll stay on course to becoming the person you want to be. The fewer the goals, the greater the resolve. Of course, that approach works only if you don't need to ask yourself multiple questions. The more goals you try to achieve at one time, the more questions you need to ask yourself. More questions make the decision waters murkier. Murkier decision waters lead to greater decision fatigue, and as you know, overcoming decision fatigue requires willpower. Willpower is a finite resource. The fewer decisions you make, the less willpower is required. Create the right environment, and willpower isn't even necessary. That means the key is limiting the number of goals you try to achieve at one time. Remember, you can be a serial achiever. You can achieve this goal, then that goal, then that goal. Focusing on one or two goals doesn't mean you're giving up on other goals. Focusing on one or two goals means you're much more likely to actually achieve those goals. And then, later, one or two of your other goals. And if you're in doubt, do this instead. Ask yourself, will this keep me from following my process? If it will, don't do it. Process is everything. Routine is everything. Let nothing stand in its way. Chapter 6. Why work smarter when you can work your number? One day I was chatting with two co-founders of a relatively successful company. They were whining about their inability to grow their customer base. "It sucks," one said. "We have to call 10 potential clients for every client we actually land." I said, "Hey, that's great. Now you know what to do. If you need 5 new clients a month, create a system that allows you to call 50 potential customers. As long as you keep selling at a rate of 1 out of 10, you'll always hit your goal." "That's stupid," the other said. I wasn't fazed. I'm used to hearing that my intellect has been weighed, measured, and found wanting. "No, it's not," I responded. "If you must get 5 new customers every month, that's what you need to do. Yes, I also hold the rank of Captain Obvious. In the meantime, you should work to refine and revise and improve your pitch, so hopefully you can someday turn that 1 out of 10 into 1 out of 7 or 1 out of 8. But for now, you know how to reach your goal. You just need to do it." Like the two co-founders, we often know or could easily calculate our number. We just don't embrace it because thinking probabilistically doesn't come naturally. I've always wanted to use probabilistically in a sentence. But when you think probabilistically, you begin to see success as the game it really is. Success is the result of rolling the dice a certain number of times. The more shots you take, the more chances you have of hitting the target. Working your number helps you predict how much failure you can expect on the road to success. Why does that matter? Failure is inevitable, sure, but failure also sucks. Unexpected failure sucks even worse, but when you know that you'll fail a certain number of times, that's okay, because you also know that you will succeed a certain number of times. That's how great salespeople overachieve. That's how great investors succeed. That's how great writers, great inventors, great entrepreneurs, great everythings succeed. Their success is based on skill, but it's also based on numbers. Plus, working your number almost always results in improving your number. When you put in the work, your rate of return on your number steadily increases. Putting in the repetitions while trying to increase the quality of every repetition is fundamental to steady and lasting improvement. Even if your goal is something kind of silly. Yes, I did 100,000 push-ups, and what that means to you. Working your number is based on consistently doing over and over and over again the things that make the biggest difference in your life. In short, working your number is about grinding, working hard every day to achieve your long-term goals. To prove that, and to prove something to myself, in 2016, I decided to do a total of 100,000 push-ups and 50,000 sit-ups, in addition to my normal workouts. I don't particularly enjoy push-ups, and I definitely don't like sit-ups. Sit-ups can just fuck right off. That was partly the point. The more you enjoy what you do, the easier it is to persevere. So how do you achieve a huge goal when that goal involves doing something you really don't like to do? Good question. Here's the answer. Exactly 100,001 push-ups later, because, hey, you can always do one more, and 50,000 sit-ups later, because that doesn't mean you have to do one more, the answer is that it was surprisingly easy. Granted, I didn't do them all in one day. I didn't have to do 100,000 push-ups all at once. I just had to do 274 a day to hit 100,000 for the year. I didn't have to do 50,000 sit-ups all at once. I just had to do 137 a day to hit 50,000 for the year. The daily numbers were still big numbers, but they weren't that big, especially compared with the total. The daily number made the distance between here and there seem short. Setting a daily number meant all I had to do was go day by day, one day at a time, and grind it out. As long as I stuck with my routine every day, success was guaranteed. That doesn't mean every day went like clockwork. Most did, but several times along the way I fell behind due to illness or personal issues. I didn't fall too far behind because most days I did an extra 30 or 40 push-ups and 20 or 30 sit-ups to build up a buffer against the occasional days that I knew I would miss. And at one point, I caught up in a big way. I did 5,000 push-ups in one day. How did that go? I have two words for you. It sucked. I didn't do 2,500 sit-ups in one day, though. No way was I going to do that. Instead, I added 50 sit-ups to my normal daily total until I caught up. The nice thing about doing 190 sit-ups per day for a few weeks is that when I went back down to 140 per day, it seemed like I got done with that day's sit-ups relatively quickly. I also worked to improve over time, because working your number also means seeking to improve your number. At first, it took me about 30 minutes to do 300 push-ups and 160 sit-ups. I always rounded up to round numbers. Within a month or so, I knocked 4 or 5 minutes off the total time. By the end of the year, a day's session took less than 15 minutes, and that was without pushing myself. I could do all the sit-ups without stopping to take a break. I could do the first set of 80 push-ups with no problem, then continue with sets of 50. To mix things up and work on improvement, sometimes I did 30 push-ups at a time with 20-second rest breaks in between. Sometimes sets of 50 with 40-second rest breaks. After all, variety really is the spice of an otherwise boring routine. Plus, and this is absolutely critical, improving at anything is always fun. Reps are repetitive, but must never be mindless. Years ago, Chuck Yeager, the first person to break the sound barrier, sent me on the wrong path. Okay, maybe it was my fault. I read Chuck's autobiography and somehow came away with the mistaken impression that a good pilot becomes a great pilot by taking great risks. It seemed superior skills could be acquired only by constantly pushing the envelope, intentionally crossing the line between control and potential disaster, and then reeling it back in. I assumed becoming not just a good, but a great motorcycle racer required taking great risks. Hey, I figured, I just ride WFO, wide, expletive, open, and by hanging out over the edge and pulling back in enough times, I would either become a great rider or... Well, I tried not to think about the or. Eventually, after far longer than it should have taken, I was forced to think about the or and realize guts had nothing to do with going fast. Maybe it was riding for another hour with, as I later discovered, two broken wrists. Or maybe it was touching an unpadded knee to the pavement at 120 miles per hour and seeing stark visual proof that a kneecap is made of bone. Or maybe it was when I realized I now thought of crashing not as an if, but as a when. But what I did realize is that successful people are successful because they approach learning in a consistent, systematic, results-focused way. Bravery isn't a requirement for success. Innate talent isn't a requirement for success. Talented, highly skilled people don't take big risks, yet they still learn to accomplish big things. How? They prepare. They train. They constantly experiment and adapt and refine. Highly accomplished people gain superior skills not by bursting through the envelope, but by approaching and then slowly and incrementally expanding the boundaries of that envelope. The key to learning is to make small, smart changes, evaluate the results, discard what doesn't work, and further refine what does work. When you constantly modify and refine a skill you already perform well, you can perform it even better. Here are two proven ways highly accomplished people learn. How to do a lot of reps, although not the kind we've talked about. Daniel Coyle's The Little Book of Talent is a cool book filled with easy and proven methods to learn to do almost anything. Here's an example. Say you want to learn to do something. Simply going through the practice motions provides little or no results. The key is to make sure you use a system that follows Dan's reps methodology. R, reaching and repeating. E, engagement. P, purposefulness. S, strong, speedy feedback. Let's take a brief look at each. Reaching and repeating. Practice should require you to operate at the edge of your abilities. In short, you have to consistently reach and constantly repeat. You can also use this approach to teach students or develop employees. Say you're leading a training session. Should you call on one person, ask a question, and have him or her answer it, or pose the question first and then randomly choose someone to answer, and maybe even turn the exercise into a game? The second is the best approach because everyone will have to reach every time, even those who aren't called on. Call on John from accounting before you ask the question, and I know I won't have to answer. I can sit back, check my email, and wait until you eventually call on me. I don't have to reach more than maybe once. Always put yourself or the people you're training in a position where you or they must reach over and over again. Don't just do what you already know how to do. Try to do what you can't do yet. That's how you learn. Engagement. Practice must command your attention and make you feel emotionally invested in striving for a goal. Say you're trying to perfect your slide transitions for a presentation. Should you run through the whole presentation 10 times or try to hit each transition perfectly, without mistakes, for 3 presentations in a row? Running through your presentation 10 times in a row will feel like death by about run through 5. Trying to be perfect 3 times in a row turns the exercise into a game you care about. Make sure the outcome of every session is something you care about. You'll try harder and be more engaged, and you'll improve more rapidly. Purposefulness. Practice must directly connect to the skill you want to build. Sounds obvious, but often what we practice has little to do with what we need to accomplish. Say you feel nervous and intimidated when you speak to a group. Should you rehearse at home, alone, until you know your material inside out, or practice speaking to small groups of people in less formal settings, like meetings? Although solo rehearsing is certainly beneficial, the only way to perform well under the pressure of standing in front of an audience is to actually speak in front of people. No amount of solo practice can prepare you for the nerves you'll feel when every eye in the room is on you. Strong, speedy feedback. Practice must provide an immediate and consistent flow of accurate information about performance. Say you're studying for a certification exam. You purchased a sample test guide. Should you take a complete test and wait until the next day to see how you did, or complete a section and immediately grade your answers to see where you went wrong and right. Take the test in chunks. Check your results right away. Immediate feedback is the best feedback. You'll better connect the dots because you're in the flow. Waiting even a day for feedback creates a mental distance and a lack of engagement that is hard to overcome, which means that much of the time you spent trying to learn was wasted. Pretty cool, right? What if you find yourself in a rep rut? Here's an easy way out, and another way to learn to do almost anything a lot better. Try one or all of these. Go significantly slower. Force yourself to go slower, and you'll identify techniques or strategies that hold you back. Plus, you can experiment with new techniques that aren't apparent at normal speed. Go significantly faster. Force yourself to go much faster than normal. You'll screw up, and in the process, you'll adapt and find new improvements. Break a complicated task into smaller parts. Almost every task includes a series of discrete steps. Pick one step, deconstruct it, master it, then put the whole task back together. Then choose another component to deconstruct. Incrementally improve enough steps and the overall improvement can be huge. Use a different metric. Pick a different measurement than you normally use to analyze your performance. Measure speed instead of accuracy, for example, or use video or audio for feedback. Watching or listening to yourself isn't particularly fun. In fact, I hate it, but you'll quickly recognize a number of ways you can improve. What if the ideal number of reps is as many as possible? Jimmie Johnson is a 7-time NASCAR champion, tied with Richard Petty and Dale Earnhardt for the most wins ever. But that's where he finished, though as of this moment he's definitely not finished, not where he started. When you look at any successful business person or successful athlete, he told me, every one of them has work ethic. Work ethic is essential, but for me, it was also the power of networking. When I was starting out, networking was the most powerful tool I had. My parents couldn't afford to take me racing. I had to meet other people, help other people believe in me, talk to people, know people, shake hands. The whole networking process is what got me my chance to drive. Then I had to worry about doing the job. I was under the impression that talent would lead to opportunity, but really, networking led to opportunity. Networking came first. Then I had to show that I could do it. I've always told my wife that for the longest time, it was who I knew and not what I knew. Once I had my shot, I had to know my stuff, but who I knew was what really opened the door to show what I could do. But I wasn't selling myself. I wasn't good at selling. When I was 19 or 20, I was on a path to get into the IndyCar space and suddenly found out that if I wanted a future in motorsports, I needed to move to North Carolina and consider NASCAR. So, I bought a plane ticket to Charlotte and lived on someone's couch. The first thing I did was buy business cards with my name and professional race car driver at the bottom. He laughed. I found out where some of the team guys would eat lunch, and every day I would show up at 11 o'clock. When people came in, I would introduce myself, shake their hands, and give them a business card. I asked if I could come to their shops, look around, learn about cars. It wasn't about selling, it was about learning. I'm a driver, and I want to learn. I went to every auto show. I went to every sponsor event I could find. I passed out my card, and every business card I received, I sent a letter to that person saying how nice it was to meet them. I put them on my fax list. I had this whole system set up to try to keep my name in front of people, and eventually, it paid off. Jimmy didn't have a specific daily number to work. He worked at it every day, and his number was as many as I can every day. His number was send a letter to every person I meet. That's a modified version of the work your number approach, one that lends itself well to a goal where the number of daily reps is at least partly out of your control. For example, Aristotle Onassis, who built a massive shipping conglomerate, always carried a notebook. "Write everything down," he said. "When you have an idea, write it down. When you meet someone new, write down everything you know about them. When you hear something interesting, write it down. Writing it down will make you act upon it. If you don't write it down, you will forget it." Richard Branson does something similar, except instead of writing down what he learns, he writes down his reaction to everything he learns, caring more about what he can do with the knowledge he's gained. Sometimes the right number to work will be as many as I can. The second most rewarding number to work, the one you own. If you're hoping to build wealth, you know how I feel about becoming an entrepreneur. Starting a business is the only way to have a chance to amass significant wealth. Do yourself a favor and use the work your number approach to get started on that goal. Every day, commit to doing one, or more if you choose, of the following until the list is complete. When you're done, you may not yet have a thriving business, but you will have laid the groundwork, and you can feel good about having done something that many people dream about but never do. Like my neighbor. He talked for at least 6 months about starting a business. Whenever I saw him, that was all he talked about. Eventually, I got tired of it. "What the heck are you waiting for?" I finally asked. It turns out he thought the process of starting a business was really complicated. "I don't want to go through all that stuff," he said, "unless I'm absolutely sure my idea is perfect." Like a lot of would-be entrepreneurs, he was stalling because he was intimidated by the apparent complexity of the administrative and legal tasks involved in starting a business. And he didn't realize that idea should always be a verb. I bet him lunch that we could take care of all that in less than 3 hours. I won. And that means you can definitely commit to knocking off one or more of the following every day. Just keep in mind that I'm talking only about setting yourself up to do business. I'm not talking about writing a business plan, sourcing financing, developing a marketing plan, actually selling a product or service, etc. The goal here is to get off square one and get onto the fun stuff. Here's your list. Step one. Get over the company name thing. Plenty of people endlessly agonize over dreaming up the perfect company name. Don't. If you're waiting until you come up with the perfect name, you're also waiting to start making money. Instead, at least for now, forget branding and unique selling propositions and all that business identity stuff. And don't worry about finding the perfect URL or website design or promotional literature. You're putting those carts way before your business horse, too. Just pick a name so you can get the administrative ball rolling. Remember, your business can operate under a different name from your company name. A doing business as form, or DBA, takes about a minute to fill out and file. And you can change your company name later, if you like. Step two. Get your employer identification number, EIN. An EIN is the federal tax number used to identify your business. You don't need an EIN unless you will have employees or plan to form a partnership, LLC, or corporation. But even if you don't need an EIN, get one anyway. It's free, it takes minutes, and you can keep your Social Security number private and reduce the chance of identity theft, because if you don't have an EIN, your SSN identifies your business for tax purposes. Note, if you're using an online legal service to set up an LLC or corporation, don't use it to get your EIN. Instead, apply online at the IRS website. Search Apply for EIN Online and choose the IRS website from the results. You'll have your EIN in minutes. And with that, it's time to head to your locality's administrative offices. Step three. Register your trade name. If you won't be operating under your own name, your locality may require you to register a trade name. In most cases, you'll be approved on the spot, unless you try to register a name someone else has already registered. Step 4. Get your business license. Your county or city will require a business license. The form takes minutes to fill out. Use your EIN instead of your social security number to identify your business, for privacy reasons, if nothing else. You may be asked to estimate annual gross receipts. Do your best to estimate accurately, but don't agonize over it. You're just providing an estimate. Step 5. Complete a business personal property tax form, if necessary. Businesses are taxed on personal property, just like individuals are in many states. Where I live, no form is required for the year the business is established. If you are required to file a business personal property tax form and you plan to work from home using computers or tools that you already own, you shouldn't need to list those items. If you purchase tangible personal property during your first year in business, you will list those items when you file your business personal property tax form the following year. If you're unsure, spend a couple of minutes on the phone with an accountant. Let me guess. This part stresses you out. Don't let it. I don't use business funds to buy any business items, computers, mobile devices, vehicles, office furniture, etc. I buy all those things using personal funds. While that does prohibit me from claiming a tax break for those expenses, it also makes my accounting life a lot simpler. I don't have to worry about using any business assets exclusively for business purposes. I don't have to worry about any accounting involved in selling or disposing of those items. I willingly trade a business deduction for simplicity. Whether you choose to do that is up to you and your accountant. But just know that when you're starting out, you can keep things really simple. Step 6. Ask your locality about other permits. Every locality has different requirements. Where I used to live, for example, a home occupation permit was required to verify that any business based in a home met zoning requirements. Your locality may require other permits. Ask. They'll tell you. Step 7. Get a certificate of resale, if necessary. A certificate of resale, also known as a resale certificate or seller's permit, allows you to collect state sales tax on products sold. In some states, there is no sales tax on services. If you will sell products, you will need a seller's permit. The website for your state's taxing authority has complete details, forms, etc., if you decide to apply online. But most localities have pre-printed forms you can complete while you're at their administrative offices taking care of other tasks. Step 8. Open a business bank account. A moment ago, I advocated for simplicity, but I won't in this case. One of the easiest ways to screw up your business accounting and possibly run afoul of the IRS is to commingle personal and business funds and transactions. Using a business account for all business transactions eliminates that possibility. Get a business account using your business name and EIN and use only that account for all business-related deposits, withdrawals, and transactions. Pick a bank or credit union that is convenient. Take a few minutes to check out your local credit unions. Often, they will provide better deals than banks. Step 9. Set up a simple accounting spreadsheet. Down the road, you can worry about business accounting software, like QuickBooks. For now, just create a spreadsheet you can use to enter and track the money you spend and the money you receive. Bookkeeping is simple, at least at first. All you need are revenue and expense columns. You can add line items as you go. Instead of spending hours playing with accounting software, dreaming up potential expense and income categories, and creating fancy reports with no data, spend that time generating revenue. As long as you record everything you earn and spend in your spreadsheet, creating a more formal system later will be fairly easy. It will also be more fun because then you'll have real data to enter. And what's even more fun is that now you'll be an entrepreneur with all the documents to prove it. And now you'll be motivated to actually build the business you just set up. The most rewarding number to work. Maybe you're still struggling to think of your and. Maybe you're still struggling to determine what goal you want to pursue. If that's you, here's a perfect use for work your number. Focus on other people. That's the Jack Welch approach. There are many things you can say about Jack Welch, and this is one of them. Jack definitely knows how to develop great leaders. That was true when he was the CEO of General Electric, and it remains true today. For example, the Jack Welch Management Institute online MBA program has been named the most influential education brand on LinkedIn and was named a 2016 Business School to Watch by Poets and Quants. As Jack told me, success is based on people first and strategy second. Build a great team and you will accomplish things beyond your wildest dreams. You grow from the reflected glory of your people. When your team delivers, you enjoy the fruit. That's why, if you're struggling to think of a way to better succeed, to better stand out, to use work your number to achieve more, you should focus on other people. Focus on doing one thing every day to develop one of your people. Focus on doing one thing every day that helps one or more of the people around you to be better. Focus on doing one thing that helps you better flex what Jack calls your generosity gene. I wish I had then had a better definition of what I now call the generosity gene, Jack said. For a long time, I never quite identified that ingredient. If a leader didn't desperately want to give raises, to promote people, if he didn't get as much satisfaction from other people's success as he did from his own, I didn't see that as well as I should have. I have never seen a great leader that didn't have the generosity gene. Take care of your people. Let them know where they stand. Cheer them. Never take credit for what they do, and they'll go to the moon for you. When you think about it that way, deciding to flex your generosity gene every day is an ideal way to work your number. Want some tips? Work your number by giving. Give greater autonomy and independence. Great organizations are built on the optimizing of processes and procedures. Still, every task doesn't deserve a best practice or a micromanaged approach. I'm looking at you, manufacturing. Engagement and satisfaction are largely based on autonomy and independence. I care when it's mine. I care when I'm in charge and feel empowered to do what's right. Plus, freedom breeds innovation. Even heavily process-oriented positions have room for different approaches. Still looking at you, manufacturing. Whenever possible, give the people around you the autonomy and independence to work the way they work best. When you do, they almost always find ways to do their jobs better than you imagined possible. That applies to your friends. If you ask someone for a favor, let them decide how they will deliver what you need. And it definitely applies to your kids. Tell them what you would like them to do, but give them the freedom to figure out how to do it. Every parent's goal is to raise children who become independent adults. So start now. Give clearer expectations. While every task should include some degree of independence, every task also needs basic expectations for how specific situations should be handled. Criticize an employee for offering a discount to an irate customer today, even though yesterday that was standard practice, and you make that employee's job impossible. Few things are more stressful than not knowing what is expected from one day to the next. When you change a standard or guideline, communicate the change beforehand, and when that is not possible, take the time to explain why you made the decision you made and what you expect in the future. And yes, this definitely applies to your kids. Children seek independence, but they also crave structure and predictability. Provide both. Give more meaningful objectives. Almost everyone is competitive. Often the best employees are extremely competitive, especially with themselves. Meaningful targets can create a sense of purpose and add a little meaning to even the most repetitive tasks. Plus, goals are fun. Without a meaningful goal to shoot for, work is just work. No one likes work. Give a better sense of purpose. Everyone likes to feel a part of something bigger. Everyone loves to feel that sense of teamwork and esprit de corps that turn a group of individuals into a real team. The best missions involve making a real impact on the lives of the people you serve. When the people around you know how their effort contributes to the business or to customers or to the community, work takes on greater meaning. That's especially true when people are given the freedom to create a mission or two of their own. Feeling a true purpose starts with knowing what to care about, and more important, why you should care. Give more opportunities to provide significant input. Engaged employees have ideas. Take away opportunities for them to make suggestions or instantly disregard their ideas without consideration, and they immediately disengage. Make it incredibly easy for people to offer suggestions. Ask leading questions. Probe gently. Help people feel comfortable proposing new ways to get things done. When an idea isn't feasible, always take the time to explain why. Employees who make suggestions care about the company. So do everything you can to ensure they know their input is valued and appreciated. That premise is even more applicable to families. After all, employees expect to be told what to do at least part of the time. Does your significant other? Do your kids? Give a better sense of connection. Employees work for a paycheck, otherwise they would do volunteer work. But they want more than a paycheck. They want to work with and for people they respect and admire, and who respect and admire them. A kind word, a quick discussion about family, an informal conversation to ask if an employee needs any help. Those moments are much more important than group meetings or formal evaluations. A true sense of connection is personal. Show that you see and appreciate the person, not just the worker. Give greater consistency. Most people don't mind a boss who is strict, demanding, and quick to offer not always positive feedback, as long as he or she also treats every employee fairly. The best bosses treat each employee differently while treating every employee fairly. There's a big difference between sameness and fairness. Consistency and fairness are based on communication. The more employees understand why a decision was made, the less likely they are to assume unfair treatment or favoritism. Give private criticism. No employee is perfect. Every employee needs constructive feedback. Every employee deserves constructive feedback. Good bosses give that feedback. Great bosses always do it in private. So do great partners and great parents. Give public praise. Every employee, even a relatively poor performer, does something well. That's why every employee deserves praise and appreciation. It's easy to recognize and praise the best employees because they're consistently doing awesome things. Maybe consistent recognition is a reason they're the best employees? Something to think about? You may have to work hard to find reasons to recognize someone you work with who simply meets standards. But that's okay. A few words of recognition, especially public recognition, might be all the nudge an average performer needs to start becoming a great performer. Give everyone a chance for a meaningful future. Every job should have the potential to lead to greater things. Whenever you can, whether you're a boss or not, help other employees gain skills or experience that will help them land the job they someday hope to land, even if that job is with another company. While that might sound odd, training people to move on to bigger things outside your business is often how it works in the high-end restaurant industry. Take Eric Ripert, chef and co-owner of the acclaimed New York City restaurant Le Bernardin, author, frequent guest judge on Top Chef, and the host of the long-running series Avec Eric. If you know anything at all about celebrity chefs, you know Eric.